I heard he is funny. With my customary Italian-American efficiency, I didn't look at the program until I was riding up here on the train. And I realized, first of all, to my horror, that I was the first speaker of the day, but that horror vanished a while ago. And then I looked at the title of my talk, and I thought, this isn't what I said. What I had originally said, and I think it got lost in translation, was a people apart, and I wanted to look at this old... No, wait, I'm not finished. This old question of separatism and integration, and to see whether that was still relevant in the African-American experience and in African-American social and political thought. But I wanted to do that looking at what black thinkers were saying now in the wake of 9/11 and in the changes that have taken place in our society. And so I thought, you know, the old Portuguese proverb really is true. God writes straight with crooked lines. What I found surprised me, and maybe something with upheaval in the title, is actually better than what I had originally thought before I thought really about the paper, and certainly before I had done the research and writing on the paper. So let me begin with that, and we'll see where this goes. More than a century ago, 1903, W.E.B. Du Bois expressed a deep yearning to be both black and American. The American Negro, Du Bois asserted, simply wishes to make it possible for a man to be both a Negro and American without being cursed and spit upon by his fellows, without having the doors of opportunity closed roughly in his face. The problem of the 20th century, Du Bois concluded, is the problem of the color line, the relation of the darker to the lighter races of men in Asia and Africa, in America, and the islands of the sea. Notwithstanding the end of segregation in the United States, the dismantling of apartheid in South Africa, and the transformation of racial attitudes that has taken place since Du Bois wrote, many scholars and critics assume that racism is so thoroughly entrenched in the structure of American institutions that we could not escape it if we tried. They are not entirely wrong, for a lingering racism continues to disgrace and may yet harm American life. Yet the failure to supersede Du Bois' analysis, even as circumstances have changed dramatically, reveals the stagnation of ideas characteristic of the 20th century, the bankruptcy of much contemporary social and political thought, and the superficiality, at least, from the outset, informed the vaunted national conversation on race. Historically, blacks' resistance to oppression took one of two forms, separatist and integrationist. As a general, though not an absolute rule, separatism flourished during periods of severe persecution and the defeat or abandonment of integrationist hopes. The quest for integration, by contrast, has prevailed whenever whites seem to be more receptive to black demands and blacks more confident of effecting reforms. Now, to give the devil his due, in the face of repeated and bitter setbacks, it is remarkable that integrationist sentiment has survived at all. Its persistence indicates that blacks know that they are Americans rather than displaced Africans, and that they understand that their fate is bound up with the fate of the United States. Then again, there is not and never was any place to which the black masses could flee. The appeal of integration suggests that they realized as much, even if their leaders and spokesmen are not always so perceptive. The stubborn realism of blacks set limits to the allure of separatism. Yet separatism has not been merely the initiative of fanatics and opportunists. As long as racism persists, separatism will command respectful attention within the black community. A decade ago, Cornel West, this week a celebrated professor of religion and African American studies at Princeton University, acknowledged that the variety of black nationalist ideologies rest upon a fundamental truth. White America has been historically weak-willed in ensuring racial justice and has continued to resist fully accepting the humanity of blacks. As long as double standards and differential treatment abound, black nationalism will thrive. Far more than the integrationism of the civil rights movement, separatism in its various forms emphasized the need for blacks to overcome their slave mentality and repudiate white paternalism, no matter how subtle or benevolent. In these respects, the various separatist movements responded to the more immediate cause of black degradation in the ghettos of the American cities than did the liberal advocates of civil rights. During the 1960s, separatism reflected the historical uniqueness of the black experience in the United States. Black separatists understood that in fundamental ways, African Americans, though American, were a people set apart who had developed what Charles de Gaulle in another context described as a national personality. Black separatists, however, did not effectively translate their cultural nationalism into a viable political program or even formulate reasonable political demands and objectives. Their call for an independent African American nation within the territory of the United States and for a separate black economy were senseless, disregarding political and economic realities. The hope that the African American community could have created its own entrepreneurial, industrial, and financial bourgeoisie represented the height of fantasy. Although integrationists did not deliver the promised victories that were to move blacks into the American mainstream, separatists remained politically naive and enfeebled. Numerous black scholars, thinkers, and political leaders, however, remain convinced that blacks must repudiate their American identity and embrace their African past. The antidote to the injustice blacks have suffered has been to recover the past heroes and lost glories of Africa. As other abused peoples have done, blacks invented a majestic past to compensate for real weaknesses and outrages in the present. The remedy is as bad, or worse than, the disease, for there is a vast difference between the reinterpretation of the past and the indulgence in unfounded and pernicious delusions. In The Debt, What White America Owes to Blacks, Randall Robertson argues that far too many Americans of African descent believe their history starts in America, with bondage and the struggles forward from there toward today's second-class citizenship. Mastering the languages, reading the literature, and studying the history of Europe and the United States are, Robinson maintains, simply not, and I'm quoting, simply not a black thing to do. According to Professor Kofi Latome of the State University of New York at Buffalo, education is now little more than a Eurocentric, elitist, and racist exercise designed to rob black Americans of their true African identity, culture, and heritage. Whites have replaced, quoting, physical enslavement with psychological enslavement. In the public schools, affirms Professor Felix Boteng of Eastern Washington University, the orientation is so Eurocentric that African American students are totally deculturized. Education in the United States, alleges Mulana Karenga, transforms blacks into obscene caricatures of Europe, pathetic imitators of their oppressors. For Molefe Kete Asante, the Eurocentric curriculum that prevails in American elementary and secondary schools, as well as in most colleges and universities, is killing our children, killing their minds. Afrocentricity, Asante contends, is the centerpiece of human regeneration. Although there is no unified African culture, Asante proclaims that there exists an African cultural system through which peoples of African descent respond to the same rhythms of the universe, the same cosmological sensibilities. Our Africaninity is our ultimate reality. Such contentions are predicated upon an understandable and impassioned, though blundering, quest for identity and power. Those who espouse Afrocentrism believe that blacks are not and cannot be at home in Western civilization and will never make a place for themselves in American society. They denigrate or ignore the achievements and contributions of black Americans and emphasize instead only the oppression and despair that they have experienced. In their view, blacks' acceptance of American standards and countenance of Western values amounts to self-abnegation and cultural betrayal. At the heart of Afrocentrism is the conviction that blacks cannot overcome the indelible and essential fact of their race. And nowhere, it seems, can they locate an admirable image of blacks, of the black self. Nowhere, that is, in the American past or the Western canon. The study of history masks a cultural imperialism that deprecates all non-Western traditions. Literature courses present the essential texts as agents of white power. Forcing black students to learn standard English only heightens their sense of inferiority and humiliation. For blacks, in short, an American education has reduced to brainwashing and mind control, Blacks must break free from America, so argue the Afrocentrists, as their ancestors once demolished the chains of slavery. Only then will blacks attain deliverance and salvation. The United States and the West are evil and in any event have dominated the world long enough. The time has come to exalt, as one sociologist recently declared, the time has come to exalt the barefoot people and to prepare for the inevitable rise, I'm quoting now, the inevitable rise of the dark world. Blacks in the United States face a serious and deepening crisis, so much so that black leaders may be excused the hyperbole of speaking of creeping genocide. They cannot hope to remedy the disorders that afflict their people by writing them out of the Western tradition and the American past. Until the 1960s, few black Americans gave much thought to their ancestral connections with Africa. In his eloquent appeal to the colored citizens of the world, 1829, for example, the abolitionist David Walker expressed his admiration for American political traditions, values, and institutions, and warned that divine retribution awaited the nation for its failure to honor the principles enshrined in the Declaration of Independence. This country is as much ours as it is the whites, whether they will admit it or not, Walker avowed. This land which we have watered with our tears and our blood is now our mother country. Frederick Douglass, the most distinguished black abolitionist, added, "No one idea has given rise to more oppression and persecution toward the colored people of this country than that which makes Africa, not America, their home. It is this wolfish idea that elbows us off the sidewalk and denies us the rights of citizenship." Even Du Bois, who spent his last years in Ghana, always regarded America as his true, if at times inhospitable, home. He admonished his black countrymen to realize that we are Americans, that we were brought here with the earliest settlers, and that the very sort of civilization from which we came made the complete absorption of Western modes and customs imperative if we were to survive at all. In brief, there is nothing so indigenous, so completely made in America as we. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. insisted that the Negro is an American. We know nothing of Africa. More recently, John McWhorter, a professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, explained that most blacks see themselves neither as African nor obviously as white. The truth is that black Americans think of themselves as a new race altogether. I feel black American, but I do not feel African. My connection with my ancestors six generations back, about whom I know nothing, feels more academic than spiritual. Despite the years of residence, toil, and misery that made Africans into Americans, the experience of blacks in the United States is without historic parallel. Enslaved and subject to a racism that at times denied their humanity, blacks have had to rely on one another to survive. Unlike other immigrants, their ancestors came involuntarily to North America. The Irish, Chinese, Germans, Greeks, Italians, Poles, Slavs, Jews, and others all faced prejudice, but none were unrelentingly condemned as an inferior race. In time, all gained access to mainstream American society, acquired a measure of political and economic influence, and contributed to the development of American national culture. Such was not the case with Africans and their descendants. Prevented from consolidating their political and economic accomplishments, and excluded from participation as equals in American life, blacks were consigned to the background and compelled to accept their status as the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. Racism situated blacks beyond the pale of American society. As a consequence, every advance that blacks made came at a tremendous cost, including the attainment of liberty. When, during the 18th and 19th centuries, slaves in the North gained their freedom, those among them who were skilled craftsmen found themselves barred from plying their trade so that they would not compete with their white counterparts. The remainder were left to fend for themselves, deprived even of the meager security their masters once provided. A similar pattern occurred in the South after the Civil War, with legal segregation replacing slavery as a means of social control. White Americans simply refused for a long time to make a place for blacks. Even as a minority of African Americans began to enter politics and the professions and to advance into the lower echelons of the corporate hierarchy, a new threat of social disintegration emerged. Whatever benefits they and their families attained as a result of upward social mobility were more than offset by the plight of those whom they left behind in a world now inundated with drugs, overwhelmed by violence, and ravaged by despair. Statistics now project that the obliteration of the black male population in the United States, if these predictions are accurate, a substantial majority of black men will, by the age of 25, either be dead in jail or on drugs. 50% of black teenagers will be high school dropouts, and 40% will be out of work and likely unemployable even in menial jobs, most of which now require a high school diploma or the equivalent. Never mind the past the blacks have endured, what sort of future is in store for many of them? As Eugene D. Genovese, the preeminent historian of slavery, pointed out a few years ago, blacks have a legitimate cause for demanding a fair measure of autonomy in attempting to solve the problems of their communities. But solve those problems they must. Blacks can find no resolution in the streets. The imposition of law and order and the preservation of common decency are essential to their survival. Given the racist history of the United States, however, many blacks bitterly resent and predictably resist efforts to have law, order, and decency thrust upon them, no matter how much outsiders reassure them that this exercise is for their own good. The bleak situation that many blacks now confront is a formula for social and political disaster, and white Americans ought to take no comfort in the thought that they have so far avoided the worst. The deterioration of the African-American community may be a symptom of the larger deterioration of community that is taking place throughout the United States, even, perhaps especially, in the most affluent suburbs. The decay of community threatens a general breakdown of civilization. Despite this shared condition, the patience of other Americans wears thin as evidence of barbarism and anarchy among blacks becomes more obvious and more widespread, even as ideologues on the left now justify such outbursts in the name of national liberation, global justice, and universal human rights. The growing frustration, anger, and anxiety, if it is allowed to continue, may spawn bitter and violent confrontations as the ruling class or certain debauched and unscrupulous elements within it use any means necessary to arrest the dissent, including an unrepentant imposition of tyranny. If in the wake of 9/11, the American people must decide between the domestic insurgency that many black scholars and leaders are now calling for and authoritarian repression, they will choose the latter. Under those circumstances, few will remember or care that blacks have been the unfortunate victims of racism. Thank you.